further north, particularly in North America and Northern Europe. Indications are that the climate in Egypt would have been much more comfortable and conducive, and much wetter and more fertile than it is today. This is not to say that Egypt was entirely spared the cataclysms of the Younger Dryas. There were powerful and destructive Nile floods, as we shall see. But by comparison with many other parts of the world, it would have stood out as an inviting refuge. As above, so below. To return to the matter of the sky-ground lock at Giza in the epoch of 10,500 BC, let us consider first the lion-bodied, and very likely once lion-headed monument, oriented perfectly due east, that we call the Great Sphinx. It looks not only at the rising sun on the spring equinox, but also at the constellation that houses the sun on the equinox. Today, therefore, this monument gazes at the cusp between Pisces and Aquarius. At the time of the building of the Temple of Karnak, it gazed at the constellation of Aries, and in the Old Kingdom, when the Sphinx was supposedly built, it gazed at the constellation of Taurus the Bull, clearly not a perfect sky-ground match. Indeed, only in one epoch in the last 25,920 years has the lion-bodied Sphinx looked out at its own celestial counterpart, the constellation of Leo, in the pre-dawn on the spring equinox, and that was in the epoch of 10,500 BC. But there is more. In that same epoch, at the exact moment that the sun bisected the horizon due east, the three belt stars of the constellation of Orion lay due south on the meridian, and they did so in a pattern that very precisely matches the pattern of the three great pyramids on the ground, thus making sublime sense of the image of Osiris Orion as the Ka, or double of the pyramids. After Robert Boval presented the Orion correlation to a global readership in his 1994 book The Orion Mystery, and after the further work I did on the subject in Fingerprints of the Gods and that Robert and I did together in Keeper of Genesis, the hypothesis came in for a great deal of criticism from the mainstream archaeoastronomer Ed Krupp of the Griffiths Observatory in Los Angeles. Krupp claimed that the correlation was upside down, an argument of some sophistry, based on the apparent curvature of the sky, which means that the highest of the three stars of Orion's belt, matched in the Orion correlation by the southernmost of the three pyramids, is effectively the northernmost star. Refuting this, we were able to demonstrate that laying the pyramids out on the ground in the way that would satisfy Krupp might be technically correct in terms of modern astronomical conventions, but would not produce an immediately recognizable and visually pleasing similitude between what is seen in the sky and what is seen on the ground, if, on the other hand, one steers clear of 21st century astronomical conventions in which north is up and simply models on the ground, rather as an artist or a sculptor would, what would have been seen in the sky at dawn on the spring equinox in the epoch of 10,500 BC, then the result is indeed a very good match, as Robert Boval has always claimed, between the three great pyramids and the three stars of Orion's belt. Moreover, as noted above, the particularly striking feature of this match is its lock with the Sphinx Leo. The point is worth re-emphasizing. Looking east in the pre-dawn, about an hour before sunrise on the morning of the spring equinox in the epoch of 10,500 BC, we see the constellation of Leo lying with its belly on the horizon, directly in line with the gaze of the Sphinx. There is an unmissable sky-ground correlation here, for the constellation of Leo in profile, as seen at this moment, does very closely resemble the profile of the Leonine Sphinx. The Earth turns, the stars and the sun rise. Light floods the sky, and in due course, after about an hour, the solar disk bisects the horizon precisely due east, again exactly in line with the gaze of the Sphinx. At the precise moment it does so, the three stars of Orion's belt fall into place centered due south over the meridian. This is confirmed absolutely by modern astronomical software, and it would have been known absolutely by anyone with sophisticated knowledge of the motions of the heavens, should such a person have been present at Giza in the epoch of 10,500 BC. Indeed, One can almost feel the ponderous gears of the sky at work, like a huge clock. The hour hand is the Sphinx-Leo correlation, and the minute hand is the pyramid's Orion's belt correlation, and both work together to point unmistakably to the epoch of 10,500 BC. This is the epoch that I long ago suggested was the mysterious ancient Egyptian first time, but that I now understand was significant for the world-changing cataclysm of the Younger Dryas as well. Dating with stars. The use of combinations of stars in the sky and large-scale constructions on the ground to point symbolically to significant moments in history was a practice widely pursued in antiquity, as extensively documented in my 1998 book, Heaven's Mirror. Indeed, examples of such sky-ground mirroring, once they are properly understood, frequently shed new light on archaeological inquiries. For example, in 2014, an ancient mound in the Republic of Macedonia was identified as man-made by archaeoacoustic analysis. The mound's dimensions are 85 meters by 45 meters. It is very precisely oriented north-south, and at its summit, placed within an oval ditch, a giant earthwork has been identified by researchers from the University of Trieste as a representation of the constellation of Cassiopeia, as it would have appeared from the site at dawn on 21 July 356 BC, the birthday of the famed Macedonian ruler Alexander the Great. Cassiopeia lies directly to the north, the researchers conclude, and stands vertically above the geoglyph in the sky's zenith, forming a perfect picture of the sky on the earth. Nor are such sky-ground endeavors confined to the ancient world. A relatively recent example is the Hoover Dam in the United States. There, at the base of the towering Monument of Dedication, with its black diorite pedestals supporting two colossal and imposing winged figures, themselves reminiscent of Mesopotamian and ancient Egyptian deities, the sculptor, Oscar Hansen, created a spectacular terrazzo floor with an inbuilt star chart. Here's how the U.S. Department of the Interior's Bureau of Reclamation describes the artwork and its purpose. The chart preserves, for future generations, the date on which President Franklin D. Roosevelt dedicated Hoover Dam, September 30, 1935. In this celestial map, the bodies of the solar system are placed so exactly that those versed in astronomy could calculate the precession, progressively earlier occurrence of the pole star, for approximately the next 14,000 years. Conversely, future generations could look upon this monument and determine, if no other means were available, the exact date on which Hoover Dam was dedicated. Hansen, who explicitly compared the dam to the Great Pyramid as a monument to collective genius, exerting itself in community efforts around a common need or ideal, also incorporated the signs of the zodiac into his design. Such elements, he said, were all put there as clues and pointers, so that in remote ages to come, intelligent people would be able to discern the astronomical time of the dam's dedication. It so happens that the Hoover Dam and its monumental sculptures were completed in the same year, 1935, but it is of course possible to use symbolic architecture and astronomical alignments to make a permanent statement about significant moments in the past at any time. A parallel might be the great Gothic cathedrals of Europe, built in the 12th and 13th centuries of our era, but referring in every symbolic detail and in the sacred astronomy built into their stones and stained glass, to much earlier periods, notably to the time of Christ and the time of the Old Testament patriarchs. From a purely astronomical point of view, what can be said about the huge effort and endeavor of the Giza monuments is that the ground plan of the pyramids and the Sphinx does speak clearly of the epoch of 10,500 BC. But as readers of my previous books will be aware, the monuments also include features such as the four narrow shafts angled up through the body of the Great Pyramid that target significant stars in the epoch of 2500 BC, when Egyptologists believe the pyramids were built. In other words, both epochs are symbolized, 2500 BC by the shafts and 10,500 BC by the ground plan. Long-lived cult of the sages. The hypothesis I derive from this is that Giza was one of several sites around the world, Göbekli Tepe was another, where survivors of a great prehistoric civilization that had been all but destroyed in the global cataclysm at the onset of the Younger Dryas chose to settle, and where their sages set in motion a long-term plan to bring about the resurrection of the former world of the gods, the recreation of the destroyed world. Perhaps they felt that their own civilization had made some terrible error, some ghastly mistake that had brought down the punishment of the universe upon them in the form of the Younger Dryas comet, and that it would therefore be impious or unwise to seek to refashion the destroyed world all at once and straight away. Indeed, perhaps it proved impossible for them to do so, though its climate would have been attractive at a time when much of the world was in the midst of a sudden deep freeze. The Nile Valley, like so many other places, did suffer cataclysmic events both at the beginning and at the end of the Younger Dryas. These events included episodes of extreme river floods, the so-called Wild Nile, that recurred several times in the epoch of 10,500 BC, with calmer and more predictable conditions not being restored until about 9,000 BC. Located on higher ground, well above the valley floor, there's no evidence to suggest that Giza itself was ever scoured by those floods, and it would therefore have been an obvious choice in Egypt for the survivors to have established a base and begun work on an architectural project, perhaps focused around certain natural features of the plateau itself. Amongst these, I would draw particular attention to the rocky hill, more than 30 feet high, an excellent contender for the great primeval mound described in the Edfu texts, as we shall see, that would much later be incorporated into the core of the Great Pyramid. I suggest that a shaft was cut down into this hill, and deep into the bedrock beneath it to create the rectangular cavity that is now nominated as the subterranean chamber, which can still only be accessed today through that same 300-foot-long shaft, now known as the descending corridor, that dives deeply into the bowels of the earth at an angle of 26 degrees. In my view, it is probably only one of several underground features that were created at that time, with others, far more extensive, still awaiting discovery. Likewise, these visitors to primeval Giza of the epoch of 10,500 BC would also have found a crest or ridge of rock, the technical term for such a feature is a yardang, protruding down slope that had perhaps already been sculpted by the prevailing winds into something resembling the head of a lion. It faced east and overlooked the Nile Valley, and it would in due course be extensively excavated and carved to form the Great Sphinx. It is likely that some substantial work was done in the epoch of 10,500 BC to free at least the front quarters of the core body of the Sphinx from its surrounding bedrock. But my view, unchanged since I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, is that the majority of the work on this project, as on the pyramids themselves, was done later and finally completed in the epoch of 2,500 BC. When the original leonine head of the Sphinx, perhaps heavily eroded, was recarved into the disproportionately small human head that it still has today. My hypothesis then and now is that the same sacred cult, housed in something perhaps like a monastery, with a very small, even negligible archaeological footprint, let us call it the Monastery of the Seven Sages, was involved in both major phases of the work, and in everything that happened at Giza in between. As I wrote in 1995, this hypothesis resolves the anomaly of the missing 8,000 years between the two epochs by supposing the star shafts of the Great Pyramid to be merely the later work of the same long-lived cult that originally laid out the Giza ground plan in 10,450 BC. Naturally, the hypothesis also suggests that it was this same cult, towards the end of those 8,000 missing years, that provided the initiating spark for the sudden and fully formed emergence of the literate and accomplished historical civilization of dynastic Egypt. Dating with light. Since the publication of Fingerprints of the Gods, I've had many years to reflect on the mysteries of Giza. It remains my view that the role of the historical pharaohs of the Fourth Dynasty was to complete and finally fulfill a much more ancient plan, first brought to Egypt in the epoch of 10,500 BC. As noted above, however, the subterranean elements of the Giza Plateau and the earliest work on the Sphinx may actually date back to the epoch of 10,500 BC. By virtue of the distinctive weathering patterns on that monument's flanks and on sections of the trench that surrounds it, highlighted in the analysis of geology professor Robert Schock of Boston University, a proto-sphinx does appear to have existed when heavy rains fell across Egypt at the end of the Ice Age, perhaps even as early as the Wild Nile period. I have long been convinced by the geological evidence that the Sphinx does in fact date back in some form to the epoch of 10,500 BC. But there's a grey area to do with events between 10,500 BC and 2,500 BC, and this concerns the megalithic temples of the plateau, particularly the Sphinx Temple, directly in front, in other words, to the east of the Sphinx itself, and the Wali Temple, which lies immediately southeast of the Sphinx, both of which are built for the most part of limestone blocks excavated from around the core body of the Sphinx, although in many cases the limestone blocks are surfaced with a veneer of granite. The orthodox archaeological dating of these structures, both of their limestone and of their granite elements, is to the Old Kingdom, specifically to the Fourth Dynasty, approximately 2613 BC to 2494 BC, in other words, to the epoch of 2500 BC. When I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, however, I was open to the possibility that they might date back to the epoch of 10,500 BC. I remain so, but in the light of recent evidence, some careful consideration is required. This is the case because an advanced scientific technique known as surface luminescence dating, which measures light energy stored in stone, has been applied to these temples. This technique seems, on the face of things, to rule out rather conclusively any possibility that the temples were created in the form we see them now in the epoch of 10,500 BC. I say, on the face of things, because there are certain problems with the new technique, which mean that any conclusions drawn from it must be carefully thought through. Most significantly, as the researchers themselves admit, surface luminescence dating relies upon the assumption that the sample being tested has not been exposed to sunlight since it was set into place in the building of which it is a part. Should there have been exposure to sunlight, even if just minutes in duration, as would happen, for example, if any later reworking of the sampled area had been undertaken without cover of a roof, then the latent luminescence is released, setting the signal to zero or near zero, and thus yielding a date that reflects the most recent reworking rather than the original date at which the building was constructed. The Giza surface luminescence dating study was conducted by nuclear physicist Professor Ioannis Liritsis and his colleague Asiminia Vafiadou, both of the Laboratory of Archaeometry at the University of the Aegean. They reported their results in detail in 2015 in the Journal of Cultural Heritage. Conclusive indications that at least some of the structures they sampled had indeed been reworked, with their latent luminescence zeroed and the clock set ticking again at the time of the reworking, are provided by sample number 4, Wali Temple limestone, and sample number 6, Sphinx Temple granite. The former yielded a very young surface luminescence date of 1050 BC, plus or minus 540 years, while the latter yielded a surface luminescence date of 1190 BC, plus or minus 340 years. These are, effectively, dates from ancient Egypt's New Kingdom, 18th Dynasty and later, and we have firm archaeological and epigraphic evidence that both the Sphinx Temple and the Wali Temple were already very ancient by New Kingdom times. Since this is so, the other dates yielded by the study must also be regarded with caution, and certainly cannot be taken as firm evidence of the date of construction of the temples, particularly in the case of sample number 3, Wali Temple granite, and samples number 7 and 8, both Sphinx Temple granite. These yielded surface luminescent